books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to our Christmas Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today we're staying in front of some Christmas TV. Later on in today's show, we'll listen to some clips of the audiobook from the cast of Ghosts, The Button House Archives, as we look forward to its final episode this Christmas. We'll also dive into the science behind James Bond. We'll talk to Charlie Mackesy about the book that inspired last year's big Christmas animation, The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse. And first up, let's chat to another author responsible for some big Christmas animations, such as The Gruffalo and Stickman, Julia Donaldson. In fact, the first two features on today's show share some DNA. How do you make an audio version of a book that's almost all illustration? Let's find out. Julia Donaldson paid a visit to the Talking Book Studios to record for us her book, Freddy and the Fairy, and I was with her every step of the way.
Hello, I'm Julia Donaldson, and I'm going to read Freddy and the Fairy. I just got here on the train, and after I had a piece of toast and a cup of tea for breakfast. Is that all right?
That's fine. That sounds awful nice, actually.
Freddy and the Fairy by Julia Donaldson. This book is produced by RNIB. Freddy found a fairy tangled in a tree. "Help! I'm stuck!" the fairy cried. So Freddy set her free. "Thank you."
As with all talking books, especially children's books where characterisation is perhaps more important, there was debate over the characters' voices.
Yeah, I'm quite pleased with that. The only thing I find a bit difficult is Freddy's voice. You know, I think I'm doing Freddy's voice. I mean, I don't want him to be too unpleasant. You know, he is a bit of a brat, quite, I suppose. You know, he's. Let me just think. I wish I had a pet. I'd rather have a dog. Do you think something a bit more like that? Uh-huh. A little rather than I wish I had.
Yeah, maybe that's a bit deep.
A little bit, not quite so deep.
My name is Bessie Bell. I'll grant you all your wishes, though I can't hear very well. Freddy thought, then mumbled, I wish I had a pet. Why, so you shall, said Bessie Bell, and conjured up a net.
Freddy and the Fairy is being recorded for blind and partially sighted listeners, but the book itself is actually about hearing problems. Julia explains more.
It's actually a book about a deaf fairy. I'm a bit deaf myself. And I had this idea ages ago of a fairy just muddling up wishes. I thought that'd be quite funny. And a little boy wishing, say, for a dog and getting something totally different. Mm. Originally, I was going to have the fairy just mixing up different people's wishes. And then actually one of my sons said to me, Mum, why don't you make the fairy deaf, and then she could just mishear the wishes. So when the when the boy wishes for a dog, he gets a frog. When he wishes for a cat, he gets a bat, and so on. But the story's got a moral, because it turns out that the little boy's mumbling, and he's covering up his mouth, he's not looking at the fairy. And once he's learnt how to talk clearly, then all his wishes start to come true.
A problem arose as we got to the end of the book.
The very ending of the book shows just in the pictures that Freddy is wishing for a caterpillar, and the fairy, probably just mischievously by this stage, she gives him a gorilla and said she pretends she hasn't heard, and he gets a gorilla, and that's just quite a funny picture. But it's just shown in the book in thought bubbles. So I thought, well, how can I do this? How can I get this over with in just a purely audio version?
A number of solutions as to how to convey the ending were discussed, including an audio description of the pictures.
The only trouble with that for this book is because it's such a... Well, Yeah, in a way, it's the only instance.
Mm. It's just the one at the end.
And also, because it's a rhyming, you know, I wouldn't want... You know, if it's not a rhyming book, then that'd be fine. Like, you do get books. I saw a book once, which is about an imaginary friend.
Mm.
And it says, you know, every time Jane went to the park, Mr. Monkey came too, and you just see there's just a picture of Jane going to the park, you know, and then it says, you know, when Jane went to school, Mr. Monkey sat in the seat next to her, and you can't see, and you sort of realise that Mr. Monkey is an imaginary friend, but if you couldn't see, you would imagine that Mr. Monkey was in the pictures, and you wouldn't, you know, so then you would need someone to explain. Though that would be the way to do it. Another voice just at the end said, hold on, and everything he wishes for comes true. I wish I had a caterpillar. Or very nearly. He's got a gorilla. So Freddie learnt the three gold rules, and now he speaks quite clearly, and everything he wishes for comes true. Ooh, ooh, meow, meow. I wish I had a caterpillar. Or very nearly. Oh, no, I've got a gorilla. I don't know if that would work like that. And it, of course, you could just say at the end, in the pictures in the book, Freddie was wishing for a caterpillar. He ended up getting a gorilla. And I thought that worked well. I just didn't think that would be that great. And so I actually sat down in this building, building with the recording studios, and I wrote an extra verse saying, you know, I can't remember off the heart, but I've written a special extra verse for this audio recording.
Now, Freddie, said the Fairy Queen. She sounded kind but stern. Before you wish again, there are three rules for you to learn. Rule one, you mustn't mumble. Rule two, don't turn away. The fairy needs to see your lips to read the words you say. Rule three, don't cover up your mouth. She can't see through your hand. Obey these three gold rules, and then I'm sure she'll understand. So Freddie learnt the three gold rules, and now he speaks quite clearly, and everything he wishes for comes true, or very nearly. A dog, a cat, a bird, a mouse. What next? A caterpillar? The fairy laughed and conjured up a super-sized gorilla.
When we had finished recording all the audio for the book, Julia joined me for a chat, and I asked her about the start of her writing career.
Well, and I don't know if you want me to go right back to when I was at school, because I just always loved writing, really, from the time I learnt physically to write. And I do remember when I was at primary school, and I must have only been about five, and I wrote a story about a rabbit who was running away from a farmer and hid behind the shop counter, but his ears were poking up, and the farmer saw his ears and thought they were his ears, but the shopkeeper said, oh no, that's two carrots. And so even at the age of five, I was writing stories about trickster animals.
And I believe your first book, A Squash and a Squeeze, actually came from a song that was written for TV.
That's right, because, I wrote songs really for about 20 years before I wrote books. I used to write lots of songs for programmes like Play School, Play Days, Play Away. And A Squash and a Squeeze was a song I wrote based on an old Jewish folk tale. And it was done on television. And many years later, I got this phone call out of the blue from a publisher saying, could they use the words of that song as a picture book? So that's how I got started in books.
What sort of songs were you asked to write then?
All sorts of really strange things. I mean, they would phone me up. They always seemed to want two songs, you know, which was quite good fun, actually, because when you got as far as you could with one, you'd go over to the other and you'd be sort of juggling them around. So, like, one time they said, could I write one song about silly slippers and another song about crumpling up bits of wrapping paper and throwing them into the bin. So I never turned anything down.
Now, with your picture books, how does the process work? Are you and, say, Axel Schaefer, who illustrated The Gruffalo, are you in the same room? Or are you?
No, not at all. I mean, he doesn't really even know whether I'm writing a new book, what it would be about. So I write completely on my own. And I don't even send the text to Axel. I'll send it to my editor, and she's the intermediary, she's the go-between. And then when Axel's doing the pictures, I'm not breathing down his neck either. You know, it's quite a separate process.
Do you ever get the illustrations back and think, that's not how I pictured him?
Well, of course, it's not going to be how you picture it. I think it's a bit like when you go on a holiday, you probably think, oh, Minorca's going to be like this, or, you know, Africa's, well, the safari park's going to be like that. And when you get there, it's never exactly as you've imagined it. But before long, you adjust to what you've actually got. So it's the same, really, with the illustrations.
Now, you're famous for your picture books, but you've also written books for older people, the Giants and the Joneses, and even older with Running on the Cracks. Will you ever write an adult novel?
If I did, I'd love to do something like Ruth Rendell. I really admire the crime writer Ruth Rendell, but especially her more psychological novels. I'd love to do something like that, but I don't really think I'm quite observant enough. A lot of my books are really quite fable-like, and it's difficult to explain, but anyway, it's very difficult to clear the decks as well. I just have such a busy life. That's my excuse anyway. It's so important for books to be available in audio. Children start off, before they can read, don't they? They start off hearing stories, hearing their parents telling stories. And I see audiobooks as being a wonderful continuation of that tradition. I was really shocked when I read that only a quite small percentage of the total number of books that there are available for blind people. And of course, when you want to write a book, you want everyone to get it. You're not trying to write for just the sighted section of the population. I think it's absolutely vital that people who are blind can get the stories.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks to Julia Donaldson. That's one answer to the question of how to make an audiobook of a mainly graphic novel. And here's another. Deep in lockdown, Red Sail talked to author Charlie Mackesy about The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse.
Hello. Welcome to The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse by Charlie Mackesy. This audiobook is dedicated to my lovely mum and my wonderful dog, Dill, and to you, wherever you are. Thank you for listening.
Charlie Mackesy, welcome to this Christmas special edition of Read On.
Thanks for having me.
For anybody who hasn't yet entered the beautiful world of The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse, can you just give them a quick introduction?
I'll try. It's a kind of graphic novel, really. It's 75% pictures. And it's a story about a boy who meets a mole, who then the two of them have an uncomfortable meeting with a fox, and they go through some struggles and then become friends. And then finally they meet a horse. But really the narrative is in the conversation, and they talk about things we tend not to talk about, or the fears or worries. And they've discovered that they're journey into vulnerability brings deep connection. And so it's a journey of connection and the journey into ourselves, into self-acceptance and love and all those things which I have struggled with but enjoy talking about and drawing and writing about. So yeah, it's an odd book and one that was difficult to make, actually, because the drawings came together independently of any idea of a book. There was a narrative, but I just had to dig deep for it and then arrange the drawings in the right order. So the book is one that you can open on any page, really, and it sits in its own right. It's not necessarily part of the story, but that was the dream. Because actually, for me, I'm not very good at reading books, so I've always liked to open a book anywhere and read a bit of it. I have quite serious ADHD, so it's always been a struggle to make it through any book. So yeah, in a nutshell, it's a simple book about relationships of a boy and three creatures.
In the introduction that you've recorded for this wonderful audiobook version, you are very honest that you have problems with reading, and you say that pictures are islands in a sea of words for you. You also say how profoundly important it was for you that an audiobook version should be available to people who have print disabilities.
Yes, or people who can't see the pages or who struggle to read, yeah. I made it from a desire to create something that I wish I could have read when I was little or when I was 30. When we cook sometimes for ourselves, we cook something that we would really like to eat and then maybe share. And I suppose I drew something that I felt I would have loved to have read, and then perhaps other people might too, but I wasn't sure. I loved Tintin and I loved graphic novels, Asterix. I liked anything that wasn't too wordy. And in the introduction, I do say that pictures are like islands. I'd say music is like an island as well. So for me, making the audiobook, it was so crucial to have music, because music for me is as important as words. And it was such a privilege and a treat to be able to read it alongside Max Richter's sounds, because I think it introduces you to a whole other dimension of emotion and inner landscape. It's so powerful, music, for me. And I've drifted off the question, but anyway, sorry. There you go. A graphic example of my inability to stay on any point.
Do you have any links to sight loss amongst family or friends?
Yes, I have a very good friend who was in a car accident and lost his sight for quite a long time. He slowly came back, but I saw him every day and kind of vicariously lived through his experience. He went from having 20/20 pretty good vision to nothing overnight, and I think that was a terrifying thing for him and me for obvious reasons. But yeah, so I spent a lot of time sitting with him and watching him move and the frustration and fear that he had, and it gave me a whole new understanding of what it was to be visually impaired. And then I had another friend who never saw. He was blind at birth. That again was a very different thing, obviously, and he was amazing to be with. The way he moved was so confident, and he was at ease with his surroundings. It was a very beautiful thing. And I just was so full of, I think, admiration for him, actually, because obviously he didn't know what it was to see. He didn't know what anything looked like or what looked like even means. And so we used to talk about that. And he was very open about it all. Those two people in my life had quite an effect on me. And I think if the audiobook, if people who are visually impaired enjoy the book, that would be another landmark moment in my life. What a privilege that is.
Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
Yes, when I work, I listen to music and audiobooks at the same time from two different devices, which is probably why I put a lot of music in mine, because I do love hearing music and I do love stories, and often audiobooks don't have music.
It's a new day. The boy leans on a stone wall and the mole sits next to him. They've been chatting a lot about quite difficult things, and gaze at an old stone house in the trees with hills rising in the distance. Often, the hardest person to forgive is yourself, said the mole. And back on the branch of their favourite tree, the fox jumps up and sits next to them. They had no idea he could do that. And then they all sit together, looking out at the wild. The hills look almost purple in the distance beyond the soft green fields. Sometimes I feel lost, said the boy. Me too, said the mole. But we love you. And love brings you home. I think everyone is just trying to get home, said the mole.
It's a wonderfully atmospheric soundtrack, which is also illustrated by sounds of the English countryside. I know that you recorded the audiobook in a barn in Suffolk in the middle of lockdown. You paint rather a wonderful picture of yourself under a mound of cushions and duvets.
The more orthodox route would have been to have gone to a recording studio, but I look after my mum and I couldn't risk any kind of interaction with anyone, to be honest. So I recorded it here in the barn. I got some scaffolding poles and some wooden poles and some blankets and cushions, and I sort of built a cave I could sit in. And I was then sent the recording equipment, which took me a while to work out how to use, because I'm more of a paper and paint person. I'm not very good with buttons. So I eventually worked out how to use it and sat in my little cave, which continually collapsed, actually. And Barney, my dachshund, used to crawl underneath without my realizing and then start snoring in the middle of recordings. Or there's often bees used to get inside it. And if it wasn't that, then I was dealing with external noises of airplanes and lawnmowers and chainsaws. So it was quite an adventure for me to try to managed to do it in a way that it was presentable.
Well, one of the messages in the book is that there is really no such thing as perfection, and that we should enjoy the imperfections in life. And it's beautifully illustrated by a crescent moon and I believe your dog's intervention.
Yes, I draw with ink and it takes about half an hour to dry, and I draw quite fast, so I tend to spread drawings everywhere and sometimes put them on the floor. And that drawing, that the mole says the greatest illusion is that life should be perfect. And Barney, the dachshund, did just walk straight across it and left these paw marks right across the drawing. And then there was another drawing. I drink a lot of tea and left a teacup on a piece of paper. And while I lifted it, it looked so perfect as the moon that I drew the characters below looking at it, asking if it was the moon. So, yeah, I like to break the fourth wall and bring real things into the work.
Did you find that drawing pictures in words, narrating the audiobook, was very different to drawing those pictures by hand from your mind?
It was a very different thing. Yes, they say a picture speaks 1,000 words, and you can very quickly describe a landscape with a few lines, whereas words I find harder. And in a way, for me, the fact that it took so long because of my weakness with technology was a good thing in the end, because I wrote and rewrote and rewrote the words and tried to hone them down. I didn't want to get too wordy, because the book is very simple and I didn't want the audiobook to be too wordy. So it did take time to paint pictures with words, and it was a thrill actually to describe the drawings with the music and then bring the words in also from the book. So all the words in the book are there, but I just filled it out with description. I described the colours of landscape and the colours of things and the trees. And yeah, in the end, I really loved it. I rediscovered the joy of words, actually.
Did you write yourself a script, or did you focus on the picture and describe it as if to a blind friend?
I did both. The problem with recording here was that often I would start recording something and I achieved what I thought was a good recording for a minute or so, and then it would be ruined by something, or they told me later that there was a central heating noise in the background, whatever. So I found that I would lose sentences that I thought I liked, you know. So I began without a script, but as time went by, when I liked certain things that had been said, I didn't want to lose them in case I re-recorded. So in the end, I did write a script, but there was no script to begin with. I'd lived and tried to describe it, as you say, to a blind friend. I think I began it in June, and I think it was only delivered in November. So it was a long journey. And I think I had 250 recorded files, of which was only one in the end.
It is a beautiful rendition of the book, and I think it really stands by itself as an artistic achievement, so that even if people have already bought the print copy, they will want to listen to the audiobook.
Well, that's a lovely thing to say. Thank you. When I heard the word audiobook, I just understood it to be someone sitting down and reading their book out loud. And to be truthful, if I did that, the audiobook would be very short, because essentially it's mainly pictures. So I realized that it couldn't just be that. And in the end, I decided to try and create an experience, sort of an album almost, like a piece of art. I wanted to be true to the book, but also it's a thing in its own right. I had a vague understanding how it'd be, but it sort of grew itself organically over time. But finding the right music was really difficult. And then when I found it, I found that that led the pace of the book. I think where we are now, there's a lot of anxiety. You know, media is quite rushed, things are rushed. So I decided to make it very gentle and slow and just let people sink into it and find some kind of comfort and peace in the sounds. And of course, a book you can pick up and put down and read at your own pace. And I suppose in an audiobook, you can pause it, obviously, but I think the pace of it was crucial to me and the rhythm of it. And all those things took a long time. But I remember playing it, bits of it, to friends during that time. And they were surprised that, oh, gosh, it's not really an audiobook, is it? Was the usual kind of response. What is this? It's like, you've got all these bird sounds and river sounds and this music. And when I listen to audiobooks, sometimes I do lose concentration and I need islands or breaks or some kind of reward for listening. And so I try to do that. Because I suppose it's for any age, a four-year-old or a 94-year-old. It's trying to meet people wherever they are in their timeline.
Yes, it's full of life lessons we might have learned when we were very young, but actually we need to remember as we go through life. My particular favourite is that time spent with friends is never wasted.
Yeah.
And you allow space for those words to sink in before moving to the next page, just as I remember my mother doing when she read me books like Aesop's Fables when I was very little.
Yes, that's well observed. I suppose the book is things concentrated. I kind of got a sieve and tried to sieve out the things that I felt mattered. And so the book became drawings with little conversations that led to a punchline, I suppose, of importance. And as you say, when we get to one of those sentences, I felt like it was crucial to leave space around the statement to let it be absorbed. Now, I think a long period of silence would have been no good, which is why I thought music was a good way of allowing things to sink in without the yawning silences.
The four characters, the boy, the mole, the fox and the horse, are all different aspects of each of us. The boy is curious but a bit scared. The mole is greedy. The fox has been hurt and the horse is wise.
Yes. The four characters are very different and do represent certainly four parts of me. And I think they're four parts of the human condition, to a degree anyway. The fox is definitely hurt by life and therefore has struggles to trust and is withdrawn and is outwardly initially quite aggressive and misunderstood probably. And the boy is naive and full of questions. And the horse is the wise bit of us. And the mole is the part of me, certainly, that is always hungry for something, sort of insatiable on some level. But the mole is insatiable for cake. But it's that kind of, I need something now, quickly, that sort of feeling. So, yeah, I think there's definitely four parts of me. But it was interesting to the audiobook because I got to discover them more deeply. You know, I could think about the characters more. The fox is very present in the audiobook, quite central presence rather than in the book, you know. Seems to be less noticeable. That interests me, actually.
Isabel Waller-Bridge has composed some music specifically for The Fox, for the audiobook, which is very arresting.
Yes. So we talked a lot about the presence of the fox and what feelings that would create if you were a timid mole and a boy who was scared of foxes. And so it was really fun doing that because she would send files through and say, you know, how do you feel about this? And that was something I've never done before, and it was in my wildest dreams, actually, to be able to write an event that someone would write music for. It's wonderful.
After that, the boy, the mole, the fox and the horse become inseparable. They spend a long time just playing and messing about. The boy reaches high and puts the mole on the horse's back, climbs up and sits next to him. He lies with the mole and then turns to sit facing back to front. He does handstands and even manages some pirouettes. The fox walks, circles them, lies and sits around looking up at the mole. Sometimes he does figures of eight through the horse's legs. This goes on for quite a while. Then they show the horse their favourite tree. And the boy stops and turns. Doing nothing with friends, is never doing nothing, is it? No, said the mole.
The book has become somewhat of an international sensation, partly because of lockdown, and quotes and pictures from it have appeared on t-shirts, school walls, even as NHS screensavers to remind us to be kind, to be patient, and that whilst the world is a wild place, it's our reaction to it that governs how we feel. You must feel immensely proud that it has chimed with so many people during such tense times.
Yeah, I would definitely say it's one of the greatest privileges of my life to discover that the NHS had put the drawings on their internal screensavers and that they were printing them out and putting them on ward walls. And then they were printed out and put on lampposts in LA and Melbourne and South Africa, you know, wherever I kept hearing or seeing people sending me images. You know, when you feel that you can make marks on paper that then help people get through a day, I can't really think of a better feeling. A lot of my life as an artist has been some kind of monetary connection to a drawing or a painting. So it goes to a gallery and the gallery sell it, you know, the exchange is like that. Whereas this was a sort of liberation and people were just sticking them everywhere and printing them out. And I really loved that. I get messages from nurses in COVID wards saying that they're around and they're also in the staff meeting room where they have coffee. And there were new drawings that weren't in the book that I did specially for them. They were the same characters, but there's one that I wrote that's there was a sort of rainbow in a dark cloud, and the boy was asking the horse, what's the best thing you've learned about storms? And the horse said that they end. And to see that go viral and go in shop windows, and they blew it up and put it on school windows so kids who were walking past could see that there was an end to this. And I found that very, very moving. Like, of all the things I've ever done, that felt like the loveliest thing. And I'd often find myself tearing up at the thought of it all, you know, because it's a strange place to find yourself.
And that asking for help is not giving up, it's refusing to give up.
I've been thinking a lot about the fox and how the fox is the least likely character to ask for help. And there's a sort of an independence in the fox and a pride in the fox. Not that he does in the book, but I think he will in future. And certainly as an English male, I've struggled to be weak and be open about the things that concern me. And I think a crisis like this can help us open up, probably.
The four friends pause for a rest at the top of a wide, deep valley. The mole looks at the snow on the tops of the trees and thinks it looks like cake icing. Sometimes, I want to say I love you all, said the mole, but I find it difficult. Do you, said the boy. Yes. So I say something like, I'm glad we're all here. Okay, said the boy. I'm glad we're all here, said the mole. Oh, we're so glad you're here too.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy
a book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
Yeah.
Today's show sees us curled up in front of some Christmas TV and coming up some ghosts and a bit of Bond. But here's a brief pointer to one of the many, many Doctor Who books in the library, going back to the 1970s and some only available from RNIB. This one is a double bill of two stories, The Forever Trap and Pest Control, with a couple of familiar narrators.
Although she had made several voyages aboard the TARDIS, Donna Noble was still surprised that travel through time and space involved so much wheezing, moaning, juddering and vibrating. As the deck pitched and yawed, Donna white-knuckled her grip on a convenient handrail and watched as the Doctor hunched over the heaving console, adjusting this, switching that, fine-tuning the other, and, very occasionally, hitting something significant with a mallet.
In The Forever Trap, the Doctor and Donna find themselves trapped on the Erebus, a purpose-built complex of luxury apartments in space. Who or what lies at the heart of the complex, and what is eating away the Erebus itself?
Field Medic Harrison was doomed. He should have listened to his brother Daffith in the first place. Right now, he could have been doing something safe and dull, like his brother, who worked in a care home back on Earth. Right now, Daffith would be paring the skin from around an ingrown toenail for a grateful elderly patient. A rich, grateful elderly patient. But here was Harrison, squelching across a pitted, muddy battlefield on Recension, a dismal, bruised planet, light years from safe and dull. Harrison was cold, wet, tired, scared half to death, and trying not to get run down by a reversing supply vehicle.
In Pest Control, the Doctor and Donna find themselves in the thick of trouble on a distant planet, where soldiers transform into monstrous beetles, and everyone falls under the threat of a huge mechanical exterminator.
The officers scattered, whickering in panic, but there was no way out. Sergeant Koblenza gasped and closed her eyes. Beside the Doctor, Padova flinched. The huge foot stamped downwards towards them.
One of many Doctor Who titles in the library, narrated by Catherine Tate and David Tennant, that's The Double Bill, Forever Trap and Pest Control. As I said, RNIB have Doctor Who books going back to the 1970s, but up next is a brand new TV tie-in. Here's Lynn Livingston.
Bloomsbury have decided to give us all a laugh in the form of the audiobook from the team behind the BBC show Ghosts. Matthew Bainton, Ben Wilbond, Jim Howick, Martha Howe Douglas and Simon Farnaby have filled in the backstories of their characters in the hilarious Ghosts, the Button House Archives, which is read by the cast.
Sadly, being a ghost does not come with a service manual, so
I
our operations here
first,
are more akin to an ongoing reconnaissance
Allison.
Mission that any preordained rules
I'm trying to answer your question.
Now, if it's ghost stories you're after, of course,
I thought it all a curse until the day you came.
Speaking as a ghost and your new best friend...
Oh, I've seen a lot, Alison. Mainly from four, right?
Given that they're ghosts, they seem to know very little about how haunting works. But these seem to be the rules, as far as I can work out from speaking to them. So, ghosts. Rules. Number one.
Can walk through walls.
And do so constantly. Bathrooms and bedrooms seem to be a favourite, though I've stopped telling Mike that as he started showering in trunks.
What's that?
Nothing. I've asked why they don't fall through the ceiling when walking on the first floor, and,
No idea!
Number two.
Can't leave.
Yeah, they can't go past the edge of the grounds. It might be different for different ones? I'll ask. Number three.
Stay how they died.
One has no trousers on.
Have a name, you know.
Because he died like that. Though he's quite vague about the details.
It was a late-night business meeting with a close colleague. The details.
One has an arrow in his neck, says that if he takes it out, it would just go back in. Sort of want to see that, but seems rude to ask. One has his head cut off, presumably executed.
In a way, yeah.
Not sure which bit is weirder, head or body?
Oh, the body, surely. Even gives me the willies and it's mine.
Number four.
Happens at random.
None of them have a clue why they're here. It doesn't seem to be unfinished business or needing to send a message or anything. Violent deaths? Though some of them don't seem to fit the bill for that. Maybe it's just potluck. Ooh, actually, only one of them seems to be old.
Excuse me!
So maybe it's something to do with going too soon?
There was a time when the wisdom of your elders was valued.
Oh, no,
by
I
the
don't mean like. Not Lady B saw what I wrote and that became a whole big thing.
The companion book to the BBC sitcom Ghosts is perfect for all the family. Everybody leaves a trace. The ghosts of Button House may have been dead a long time, some of them a very long time, but they have all left their mark on the world, even if, in Robin's case, that mark is just a handprint on the wall of a cave. Gathered together in this volume is a treasure trove of unearthed cuttings, original records, and rare artefacts that explore the unseen lives of those who died at Button House, from Thomas's love letters to Pat's summer camp rap, and from Julian's campaign promises to Lady Button's rules of etiquette. There are even documents dedicated to the one person who can see and hear the ghosts, Alison Cooper. Written by the show's creators, this archive is a unique chance to discover more about the beloved ghosts of Button House.
Okay, this all of history as I remember it. Well, was big walk, bit cold, then bit less cold, then hunt, then bear, then dead, then nothing. Then new tribe, then tribe died, then nothing. Then more nothing. Think went mad for a bit. More nothing. Oh, then man chop tree. Make field. Then crop. Then crop die. Then pig. Then pig die. Then man die. Then nothing. More nothing. Went mad again. Nothing. Oh! Saw first pot. Don't really see fuss, but okay pot. More farm. A stone house. Ugly? New farmer? Ugly? So first bit metal. Remember thinking, look good for hitting. But they make plow, idiot. Then come big bully with a load of other bully. Say, farm us now, you us now. Cruel, hard, mean. Remember thinking, I like this guy. They hang around for a bit. Then, dunno, bored, I guess, off they go. But all stays same. Boring, boring, went mad again. Pat says it's dark age, but light seems same to me, I don't know.
Ghosts, the Button House Archives, is written by Matthew Bainton, Ben Wilbond, Lawrence Rickard, Martha Howe Douglas, Simon Farnaby, and Jim Howick, and runs for 3 hours 50 minutes. It's read by the authors and the rest of the cast.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
The season of goodwill and generosity is well and truly upon us. And this Christmas, there's a way of supporting RNIB that won't cost you a penny. Just collect used stamps from your cards and parcels, and we will recycle them into much-needed funds. For full details and to order your collection box and prepaid envelope, visit www.rnib.org.uk/stamps or call 0330 002 0051. And have a very Merry Christmas.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
And finally, on today's show, let's settle down in front of the latest Bond movie. Dr. Catherine Harkup is a former chemist and author. She completed a doctorate,
on our favourite chemicals, phosphates, and then went on to further postdoctoral research before realising that talking, writing and demonstrating science appealed a bit more than hours slaving over a hot fume hood. Among her many science books are A is for Arsenic, The Poisons of Agatha Christie, more of which later on. We'll also touch on her book Making the Monster, The Science of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. But Catherine was at the Wigtown Book Festival to talk about super spy science. Science, death and tech in the world of James Bond.
A white dot moves across the screen. A man appears at its centre. The circle follows him as he walks. Suddenly he turns, aims a gun, and shoots. Red washes down the screen, and loud, familiar notes blast out from the speakers. Bright colours, abstract shapes, and silhouettes of writhing women appear. Within seconds, we know exactly where we are and what to expect, more or less.
The audio version of Super Spy Science is read by Nikki Diss.
The James Bond theme, the gun barrel sequence, the highly stylized titles, it was all there from the start. The only things missing from the first Bond film were a pre-title sequence and a title song. The following 24 films would be introduced in almost the same way, rearranged and reinterpreted, but instantly recognisable as part of the same franchise. Each new cinematic edition is simultaneously comfortingly familiar and new and exciting. It is an impressive trick the producers pull off, repeatedly reinventing a highly formulaic series of films that draws audiences of millions back for more, time and time again.
Super Spy Science is a fun look, very tongue-in-cheek, at the science of James Bond. All of those big gadgets, the big plans to take over the world, and whether they've been based in a grain of truth or if they're just the figment of some fevered imagination.
And you're more interested in the evil side of James Bond.
Much more fun, in my opinion. James Bond is fantastic, but he's only ever as good as his villains. If he's not up against a credible foe, then why would we be interested in him? And James Bond is remarkable. He has a fantastic set of skills. He has Q Branch behind him, inventing all sorts of things. But the villains, I think, get a bit more creative and they're a bit more, well, they're quite ambitious in their goals. So that's the side of it that appeals more to me.
The bad guy is living in very comfortable and technologically well-appointed seclusion, a subterranean palace located on Crab Key Island, with a dragon and swamp to deter visitors, but also luxurious guest accommodation and prison cells for those who can't take the hint, along with a nuclear power plant on the side. With elaborate courtesy, the villain explains his plan for world domination, disrupting rocket launches from the USA using some kind of nuclear-powered radio transmitter. And the villain does all this before trying to kill Bond in an extravagant and convoluted way that enables his escape. The film finishes with a spectacular set piece involving lots of explosions and Bond getting the girl.
Now, if you were a villain living in a hollowed out volcano, wouldn't that smell quite a bit?
Yeah, it would smell an awful lot like rotten eggs. It would be extremely unpleasant. But I imagine that Blofeld is just going for the looks, and it does look incredible. I just wouldn't want to be there. So I'm quite happy that it's just on screen and I don't have to be in the vicinity. But I love all of those big, fantastic sets. Absolute credit to the filmmakers. They're brilliant.
Dame Agatha Mary Clarissa Christie, 1890 to 1976, the Queen of Crime, holds the Guinness World Record as most successful novelist of all time. She has been outsold only by the Bible and by Shakespeare, and is more widely translated than the Bard. Christie is also the author of the world's longest-running play, The Mousetrap,
and created not one but two of the best-known fictional detectives, Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple. Praise, prizes and awards have been heaped on Christie for her work, and her books and plays are still loved by millions.
Now, a lot of our listeners are big fans of the audiobooks of Agatha Christie. Tell us about your book, A is for Arsenic.
A is for Arsenic is a very deep, well, it's a deep dive into the poisons that Agatha Christie used in her murder mystery novels. So Agatha Christie is well known as the Queen of Crime, but she is also the Princess of Poisons. She used more poisons more often to kill more characters more accurately than any other crime writer. And her use of poisons, for me as a chemist, is incredibly creative. And some of those poisons, they're almost like an extra character in the book. They are so evocative of the golden age era of crime. And I was just fascinated about how she used them, what clues she might reveal in their use, and how credible it was.
Christie's detective stories repeatedly demonstrate that she was a master of misdirection. She presented clues fairly and in plain sight, often drawing attention to them, but safe in the knowledge that most readers would form their own wrong conclusions. When the murderer is finally revealed, readers are generally left kicking themselves that they didn't spot the obvious, or they cry foul and go back to the beginning, only to discover the clues were there all along. Christie took advantage of her detailed knowledge of dangerous drugs to help develop her plots. She used poisons in the majority of her books, far more than any of her contemporaries, and with a high degree of accuracy, but she did not expect the reader to have detailed medical expertise. The symptoms and availability of drugs are succinctly described in everyday language, and somebody with a degree in toxicology or medicine has no real advantage over any other reader. Chemists, pharmacists, and similarly qualified people may be able to eliminate certain possibilities early on in the novels, but the revelation of the murderer is just as surprising to them as it is to anyone else. An understanding of the science behind the poisons Christie used only gives a better appreciation of her cleverness and creativity in plotting.
And our use of potassium in Dumb Witness is a particular favourite of yours.
It is a bit of a favourite of mine. Dumb Witness is perhaps not one of her best known novels, but it is a really creative use of a poison I don't think many people have heard of, but it's certainly, it would have been more known at the time she was writing, back in the 1930s, that particular novel was published. And it has just a fascinating history, which I dive into a bit in the book, as well as her particular use of it. So it's part history, it's part sociology, part criminology, real-life crime, as well as murder mystery.
Now, two of your books we have in the RNIB Talking Books Library are Death by Shakespeare and your book about Frankenstein. Tell us how we could build a body.
Oh, it's tricky. I don't know why, but Victor Frankenstein, for some reason, he built his body from bits. He didn't get a complete corpse and try and bring it back, which I think is a mistake. That seems to me an extra lot of work. It's going to be very difficult today. Getting hold of body bits is not easy. It's also illegal, I would like to add. Please don't do it. But back in Mary Shelley's day, it was frighteningly easy because it was the day of grave robbers and body snatchers that were supplying anatomy schools. So she would have heard all of those gruesome stories and gave all of those skills to Victor Frankenstein and then had him stitch them all together and bring them to life with the other fascination of the day scientifically, which was electricity.
Now, I know the James Bond books haven't held up well in today's society, especially in the age of Me Too and the age of trying to live a healthier, cleaner, non-smoking life, but recommend a good James Bond title for us.
I would recommend, so this is complete personal prejudice that I am going to recommend this one. I am going to recommend Moonraker because it is set not in exotic locations or far-flung parts of the world. It's in the bit of the UK that I grew up in, which is Kent. So when he's talking about a lorry chase up a hill, I know that hill extremely well. And it's a very far-fetched novel, but it is also the one novel in the Me Too movement where he does not get the girl. The girl walks straight past him and into the arms of her future husband. So it's got a very nice ending from that point of view.
Catherine Harcup's books Making the Monster, The Science Behind Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and Death by Shakespeare, Snakebites, Stabbings and Broken Hearts are both available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. A is for Arsenic and Super Spy Science are both available in audio commercially, and the RNIB version of Moonraker is read by George Hagen.
The 238s roared simultaneously. The walls of the underground room took the crash of sound and batted it to and fro between them until there was silence. James Bond watched the smoke being sucked from each end of the room towards the central Ventaxia fan. The memory in his right hand of how he had drawn and fired with one sweep from the left made him confident. He broke the chamber sideways out of the Colt Detective Special and waited, his gun pointing at the floor, while the instructor walked the 20 yards towards him through the half-light of the gallery. Bond saw that the instructor was grinning. "I don't believe it," he said. "I got you that time." The instructor came up with him. "I'm in hospital, but you're dead, sir," he said. In one hand, he held the silhouette target of the upper body of a man. In the other, a Polaroid film, postcard size. He handed this to Bond, and they turned to a table behind them, on which there was a green-shaded desk light and a large magnifying glass. Bond picked up the glass and bent over the photograph. It was a flashlight photograph of him. Around his right hand, there was a blurred burst of white flame. He focused the glass carefully on the left side of his dark jacket. In the center of his heart, there was a tiny pinpoint of light.
George Hagen reading from the RNIB version of Moonraker, as recommended by chemist and author Catherine Harcup. That's it for our Read On Christmas mashup. We'll have some of our book festival specials on over the festive period, and you can always find every episode online. Just type RNIB Read On into your favourite podcast app, and have a very Merry Christmas.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.